From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Gary Cole. He co-stars on HBO's Veep as the socially inept pollster Kent Davidson.
It's not that you are unlikable. It's that there's a perception that you are unlikable.
Cole also played the smarmy boss in Office Space, a film that eventually became a cult hit, something Cole realized when strangers started quoting lines to him.
Did you get the TPS reports?
Yeah. Without even stopping me, just saying the lines to me. And I was dumbfounded. I thought this movie tanked.
Also, an onstage interview with cartoonist Daniel Clowes. His comics Ghost World and Art School Confidential were adapted into films. He'll talk about his new graphic novel and what it's like to return to his childhood home.
Is that an enjoyable experience?
No.
No.
It's fraught with emotional peril, I will say.
First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You've probably seen our guest Gary Cole in a dozen movies or TV shows, maybe without realizing it. He was the smarmy, patronizing boss in the Mike Judge film Office Space. He was in the comedies Talladega Nights and Pineapple Express. He currently has roles in the PBS series Mercy Street, the HBO series Veep, which is now in its fifth season, and he just finished up a turn in the CBS series The Good Wife, which aired its final episode Sunday. Cole got his start as an actor in Chicago, where he performed with the Steppenwolf Theater Company. Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies spoke with Gary Cole. They began with his role in Veep, which centers around an inept vice president, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and her inept staff, who are really over their heads when the president resigns and she becomes president. Cole plays Kent Davidson, a senior political consultant and political polling expert who has no people skills. Here's a scene from last season after the vice president has become president. Kent has just conducted a poll on public perception of the president's daughter, Catherine. They're in his office, and he's about to tell her the results. Catherine is played by Sarah Sutherland.
This is about the brand image of Catherine Meyer, TM. I asked you in because, Catherine, America doesn't like you.
What?
That sounded way too harsh when boiled down to a headline thought.
Let me see that.
It's not that you are unlikable. It's that there's a perception that you are unlikable.
They hate me.
I wouldn't say hate. You just polarize opinion with the bulk of it gravitating to this poll here. Oh, my. You have sharp shoulders.
This is like high school all over
again.
Yeah,
sure, kind of, but much bigger. So let's talk about changing your narrative. Customary shortcuts to public affirmation are military service or childbirth.
Okay, God, no. And oh my God, no. In that order.
Okay, well, then we go back to the idea of turning that frown into the inverse of a frown.
Upside down?
If you will.
And that's our guest, Gary Cole, setting the president's daughter straight in the HBO series Veep. Well, Gary Cole, welcome to Fresh Air. You play Kent Davidson, who's this, senior political consultant who knows all about polling.
Yeah. When he was first described to me by Armando Iannucci, the creator, he basically said he was a highly, highly intelligent person with virtually no people skills whatsoever. Even though his whole job was to, like, measure the perceptions of people.
I mean, this is, you know, here's a situation where some human empathy is called for, and you look in yourself and find what?
Not much. He tries. He tried to be, I mean, he could have been harsher, I guess, but he's just incapable of that kind of even false empathy that most people summon when they have to do something like that. Even though they may not believe it whatsoever. He just was like, well, this has got to be done, and, no one should have hard feelings about it. You know, he tried to be empathetic, you know. I mean, I love the little moment that they wrote about, you know, he actually very reluctantly tries to soothe her by touching her on the shoulder and then recoils because he says her shoulders are sharp. I mean, that was just the greatness of the writers.
You know, the writing in this show is so terrific. I just love the pacing of it. And there's a scene, I think it's in the first episode of the new season, where the president is facing a Florida-style recount. And you and a bunch of her advisors are in a room, and they discover that the opposition has scored this really prestigious guy to run his recount effort. And people go around the table, and they have these emotional reactions, like, you know, that are often profane, like, oh, my God, we're screwed. Oh, this is terrible. And do you remember your two-word reaction in the script?
I don't. You'd have to remind me.
Not optimal.
Yeah. There is an element of Mr. Spock all the time. We always make the jokes that, you know, Kent should have some, his right. Ears should be pointier than they are.
If there's bad news, it's not optimal.
Right.
Yeah, the pace in these scenes is often really quick, and the timing is really precise. I'm guessing there's not a lot of improvising in these situations.
Well, there is improvising, but a lot of the improvising is actually done in our rehearsal periods, which there is a considerable amount of. And usually what will happen is the writers will present their first draft. We will read the draft around a table. Then we will get up and we will take certain scenes and redo them, but basically throwing the scripts to the side and kind of improvising the whatever the action of that scene that we've just read is. And then the writers observe that, and sometimes we stop and start, and they suggest other things. And from that, the writers go away and come back with a whole nother draft, and that process can actually take place again. So the show is essentially a scripted show, but it's generated, a lot of the material comes out of improvisation. It's not to say that there isn't improvisation in front of the camera. There is. We do a thing where we call it it's a free one or it's a freebie or one for fun after we get a take that everybody is satisfied with. So there is a loose and spontaneous feeling in front of the camera as well, and there is improvisation used, but it's used around a pretty firm script.
You know, one of the things about Veep is, I mean, a lot of this dialogue is profane. These are like deeply cynical people. But they're hilariously profane. I mean, so like creatively profane. Is that written? Is that improvised?
It's mostly written. Sometimes it can happen accidentally. But there is a lot of crafting of the F word that goes on in the Veep writer's room and how it can be executed. It really is a contest in terms of who can come up with, you know, maybe the most vulgar line of the day, you know, and they take it seriously. And so we're the benefactors of that.
I want to talk about Office Space, which is a film, a 1999 film by Mike Judge, which, you know, some of our listeners may not have seen or heard of, and many others have seen many times and can repeat dialogue from. I'm in the latter group. You play the boss, Bill Lumberg. How did you get the role?
I got it was pretty standard. I got it through my agent, and Mike Judge was doing this script. I had not met Mike before that, I don't believe. But for Lumberg was unusual because Lumberg and the character of Milton that Stephen Root played were both in this little, there were two little animated shorts that Mike did a decade before he did the movie. And in them, it was Lumberg and Milton. And it was basically Milton sitting at his desk mumbling to himself and Lumberg coming up and peeking over the cubicle and, you know, terrorizing him. And, you know, you watch and you go, yeah, of course, I know that guy. I've worked for that guy. Everybody's worked for that guy. And so I didn't assume to do anything else other than that. I just said, well, I can't do it better than that animation, so I'm just going to do that. I'm going to rip that off and take it off, you know, walk in there and do that the best I can.
All right, well, let's listen to the classic scene, which is when you as the boss, Bill Lumberg, comes to the cubicle of this guy, Peter. You're working at a software firm in the 90s, and Peter's played by Ron Livingston, and Lumberg has a little bit of an issue to raise.
Hello, Peter. What's happening?
We have sort of a problem here.
Yeah, you apparently didn't put one of the new cover sheets on your TPS reports.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry about that. I forgot.
Yeah. You see, we're putting the cover sheets on all TPS reports now before they go out.
Did you see the memo about this? Yeah. Yeah, I have the memo right here. I just, forgot. But, it's not shipping out till tomorrow, so there's no problem.
Yeah. If you could just go ahead and make sure you do that from now on, that would be great. And I'll go ahead and make sure you get another copy of that memo. Okay?
Yeah, no, I have the memo. I've got it. It's right.
Hello, Phil. What's happening?
And that's our guest Gary Cole as Bill Lumberg, the boss, in the movie Office Space, which was made by Mike Judge. This was a movie that didn't exactly do well at the box office, but has become this cult hit on video. It's about, you know, the office culture and the things that annoy you. And, you know, some actors pretty well known, some not so well known. Did it feel like something special was happening when you were making this film?
Yeah, well, I knew when I saw the animation. I said, well, that works. I mean, that just flat out works. because I, even though it was an animation, I said, I recognize that guy. I recognize his cadence. I recognize that snarky kind of passive-aggressive attitude. And that's what I went in to mimic when I auditioned for it. And when we were all doing the movie, we all recognized that Mike Judge was a very gifted writer and director and an animator as well. And the way he shot the movie was so specific. I mean, he was down to the minutest of details. He knew what he wanted, you know, seemingly all the time. So we all knew that what we were working on was really good. But no one had any idea that it would have any kind of a, you know, you never know if a movie will break through or if it will have any kind of lasting impact. But, you know, that's what happened.
Do people repeat these lines to you when you see them on the street?
Well, that's why we all compare notes because the movie's lasted sometimes. We see each other because there's been reunions and whatnot. A year after the movie came out, and like you said, it didn't do well in the theater, so we thought, well, this movie died, you know, did its 5 weeks and it's gone. I mean, you know, maybe somebody will see it on a shelf and rent it. But a year after that, I was doing a play in Chicago, so I was on the street a lot. I was walking to and from the theater. I live right by there. And people start shouting out, "Did you get the TPS reports?" yeah. Without even stopping me, just saying the lines to me. And I was dumbfounded. I thought this movie tanked. You know, what happened? That was right at the time when DVDs had started to peak. And I think, you know, the way people consumed movies changed. In other words, a movie wasn't necessarily a failure if it didn't do well in the theater. It could have a life after that. And Office Space was one of those films.
We're speaking with Gary Cole. He plays the political consultant Kent Davidson in the HBO series Veep, which is now in its fifth season. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with actor Gary Cole. He has an ongoing role in the HBO series Veep, which is in its fifth season. You grew up in Illinois, north of Chicago, right?
I grew up in Rolling Meadows, Illinois. That's uh-huh. where I grew up.
So what kind of a kid were you?
I guess fairly normal. We had a, you know, we lived in the suburbs of Chicago. It was a fairly, at that time, they were pretty much brand new. I remember my block had a lot of, there was about five houses on the block and about 14 holes in the ground for new houses to be built. Hmm. And they all went up in like, you know, 6 months. And, you know, lived there till I went to college. I did regular stuff. I played Little League and my sister was 2 years older than me. That's how I actually got interested in performing. She was a musician, and that's the first time I went to the theater, was to see her.
And what appealed to you about it?
I wanted to be on the stage as opposed to sitting in the audience where I was. And I had no other big plan other than that. I was a wannabe athlete in high school, but it was becoming clear quickly that that was not going to be my huge spotlight. So I got involved.
Yeah. You went to the Steppenwolf Theater, the company in Chicago, which has produced a lot of great talent. And I wanted to talk about your role in the miniseries Fatal Vision. This was in 1984, and that was, you were doing theater when you got that role, right?
Right.
Now, this was 30-plus years ago, and I saw that miniseries. I still remember scenes from this. I mean, it really left an impression. This is about a very famous and controversial murder case of an army physician named Jeffrey McDonald. How did you get the part?
Well, like a lot of people get their first part in Hollywood, I got it because eight people said no. It was very flukish. I was in Chicago. I hadn't been, the only thing I had done on camera was 2 weeks on a movie of the week that happened to shoot in Ohio, and that's why they had some Chicago actors in it. There was a casting director that was a friend of mine in Chicago. She knew some of the brass at NBC. I had previously went for an audition for the old 80s hit Miami Vice.
Oh, yeah.
I read for Don Johnson's role, yeah. And in the meantime, this miniseries was getting together, and they had Carol Malden, they had Andy Griffith, they had Eva Marie Saint, they had basically everybody in place, and they were ready to go. But they didn't have this guy because they kept offering it to people. I think they offered it to Christopher Reeve and Alec Baldwin, and everybody said no, and it wasn't really the it wasn't a very heroic character, certainly. And then somehow I wound up on the list and found myself on a plane to L.A. I read for it, and the next day, I was so naive that I got the part, and I didn't even realize that I got it. People were measuring me for coats and stuff, and I'm going, do I have the job? I can't figure it out. Because it was all like a dream, you know. I mean, it didn't make any sense to me how I got there. But sometimes that's, you know, that's the way it goes.
Well, it's a 4-part miniseries, and it's a murder case, and everything is controversial about it, including the book Fatal Vision, which the miniseries was based on. And it's the story of this guy Jeffrey McDonald. He was an Army doctor at Fort Bragg. I'll just summarize this. I mean, who calls 911 one night to report a stabbing. Police come, and his wife and two young daughters are beaten and stabbed to death. And he tells investigators that Manson-style hippies came in and attacked him and killed them. The Army was going to try him. The charges didn't quite come together. He was eventually tried and convicted many years later of the killings. He's always maintained his innocence. So let's listen to a scene here. This is where you, as Jeffrey McDonald, are being interviewed by Army investigators who don't quite believe your account of what happened. And we'll hear a question first played by an investigator played by Barry Corbin.
Okay. We have three people here, overkilled almost, and yet they leave you alive.
Well, maybe they assumed that I was dead.
If we could drift back a little bit. You say in the initial assault there was screaming. Was it screaming or were there...
What, words?
Like what?
Well, I remember hearing my wife saying, Jeff, why are they doing this to me?
This is while you're still on the couch.
Right. I heard some screaming, and then I heard Christy, but Kimmy, the older girl, saying, Daddy, 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 Daddy. This is something I can't figure out. You know, I've gone over this 100 times in my own mind. There's so many unanswered questions.
And that's our guest Gary Cole playing Jeffrey McDonald, convicted for the murder of his wife and kids. I guess it was in 1970 at Fort Bragg. This is a fascinating story. McDonald said he was innocent then, still says, so he's still in prison in California. How did you decide to play him and his posture, his perception of his own role in this?
I talked about that with the director, the late David Green, who was a great director and also a real character, too. I decided to play him regardless of what was true or not, what were the facts. I decided to play him as a guy who's innocent. Whether the audience thinks he's bluffing or lying or not, I didn't want to play a guy trying to deceive people. So I played it straight ahead. The script was kind of skewed against him, I think, the way that they presented it.
So this was a really compelling story and a terrific miniseries to watch. At least that's my memory of it. What did it do for your career?
Well, I was a stage actor in Chicago. That's what I was. That was the ceiling of it. I was very content, but it immediately introduced me to... First of all, it introduced me to how to work in front of a camera, at least initially. And I got an invaluable baptism because I was basically in everything. I worked, you know, every day, all day long. You know, and when you're working with Carl Malden and Eva Marie Saint and Andy Griffith, and you're 27 years old, you don't believe you're supposed to be there. And they were all very generous with their experience and their wisdom, and I just sucked it up like a sponge. I was beside myself, along with the director too. So it was just a great first experience. I'm sure it's not everybody's first experience, but for me it was just invaluable. But I think I came out of that with a pretty good understanding of what you need to go after.
We're listening to the interview Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies recorded with Gary Cole, who co-stars in the HBO series Veep. We'll hear more of that interview after a break, and we'll feature an on-stage interview with Daniel Clowes, whose comics Ghost World and Art School Confidential were adapted into films. He has a new comic. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the financial services firm of Raymond James, offering personalized wealth management advice and banking and capital markets expertise, all with a commitment to putting clients' financial well-being first. Learn more at raymondjames.com. And from LifeLock, reminding consumers that when shopping online or using public Wi-Fi, a trail of personal information is left behind, increasing risk of identity theft. More at LifeLock.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies recorded with Gary Cole. On the HBO series Veep, Cole plays Kent Davidson, a senior political consultant and political polling expert. Cole had a recurring role on The Good Wife, which broadcast its series finale last Sunday. Cole played the patronizing boss in the film comedy Office Space.
You've had so many roles, dramatic roles and comedic roles. And I thought we'd play a scene from Talladega Nights, directed by Adam McKay. This is the story in which Will Ferrell plays Ricky Bobby, the champion stock car driver. And you play his daddy, Reese Bobby. His name, last name really was Bobby. You play Reese Bobby. And this is a scene where Ricky Bobby's a kid in grade school, and you've been out of his life for quite a few years. But you surprise him one day by showing up at his dad's career day at school.
Excuse me, darling. I'm Reese Bobby. I'm here for career day with my son, Ricky.
Dad!
Hey there, boy! Man, you got big. How long's it been? 3-4 months?
10 years.
10 years? Man, I got to lay off the peyote.
Mr. Bobby, there's no smoking in here.
Oh, it's all right, darling. I'm a volunteer fireman.
Okay, I am a semi-professional race car driver and an amateur tattoo artist. And the first thing you gotta learn if you're gonna be a race car driver is you don't listen to losers like your know-it-all teacher over here.
Okay, I think that's enough.
Your teacher wants you to go slow, and she's wrong, because it's the fastest who gets paid, and it's the fastest who gets late. Oh, yeah. You know what I'm talking about.
And that's our guest, Gary Cole.
Father of the year, Reese
Robbie. Yeah, right. Letting the kids know what's real on in Talladega Nights. There are a bunch of funny scenes with you where you're showing, you know, Ricky Bobby the ways of the world. This must have been a lot of fun.
This was, it quite possibly could be the most fun I've had, I think. It was a combination of being with Will Ferrell, that character, who both Will and Adam McKay came up with, the character of Reese Bobby. It was just a joy. And you know, Adam McKay, and I'm so glad that he's just on fire now, because he can do anything. He's like a writing machine on his feet. I mean, like in that scene you just played, I remember standing in front of the kids, and he would just hurl, you know, one-liners at me. You're an amateur tattoo artist. I mean, he would just feed those. There's an hour of other weird occupations that I stood there and, you know, rattled off while he was doing that. But yeah, it was great fun. It was a great spoof on a very popular, you know, sport and culture that was, you know, that I don't know that they'd really done a comedy about. And it just had, you know, it was just full of great people. John Reilly and the late Michael Duncan, and you know, it was a guess.
One more question, maybe a silly question, but your name is very similar to that of the late Gary Coleman, who was the successful child actor, and I wondered if, I mean, obviously people wouldn't confuse you in person, but if in memos or casting lists you ever got confused.
Continually, and that's true. So what happened was, when I came to, basically, right after Fatal Vision was when I first, because once I, the first time I came to Los Angeles, I went straight to work. I wasn't going to auditions because I was like working. I think I had like one audition during Fatal Vision on an off day. But after Fatal Vision wrapped, then here I was in Los Angeles, all of a sudden going into casting offices. Now, if you remember in 1984, that was, I think, like the height of Gary Coleman on Different Strokes. You know, and on the same network that the miniseries was on NBC. So for the first year I was in Hollywood, when a casting director opened the door to the director and the producer sitting there, I was invariably introduced as, "Gentlemen, I'd like you to meet Gary Coleman." "Oh, I'm sorry, Gary Cole." And of course, it was a nice icebreaker for, you know, a few minutes, talking about, "Oh no, I'm Gary Coleman." And then I would proceed to, you know, stink up the room. But yeah, that happened quite a lot, because he was, you know, at that time he was kind of right in the main wheelhouse there.
But you didn't get sent to parts for a 12-year-old.
No, we never went up for the same part, as I recall. You know, with that, I actually had an idea once, and I wanted to run it by him, but he passed away, because I had done a couple of Funny or Die things because Will and Adam McKay, who founded Funny or Die, and I did a couple of those before, but I had an idea that me and Gary Coleman should do one in the waiting room of a casting office and play with that mistaken identity, but wasn't meant to be.
Would have been fun. Well, Gary Cole, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Gary Cole stars in the HBO series Veep. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. After we take a short break, we'll feature an onstage interview with cartoonist Daniel Clowes, whose comics Ghost World and Art School Confidential were adapted into films. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Staples, with thousands of printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen. And from Baird, employee-owned and independent, Baird has kept clients' financial interests first since 1919. RWBaird.com has more information.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The cartoonist, graphic novelist, and screenwriter Daniel Clowes has been one of the most influential artists in the independent comics world for the past three decades. His comics Ghost World and Art School Confidential have been adapted into movies, and Clowes was nominated for an Oscar for co-writing the screenplay for Ghost World. Clowes also wrote the screenplay for the adaptation of his comic Wilson that will star Woody Harrelson and Laura Dern. It's scheduled for release in the fall. Daniel Clowes has a new comic book, his first in 5 years, called Patience. Beautifully rendered in full color, Patience is a love story full of tragedy, regret, and time travel. Last year, Fantagraphics released a 2-volume hardcover 25th anniversary edition of Clowes' comic book series, 8-Ball. We're going to hear the onstage interview he recorded with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger at the Free Library of Philadelphia.
So, Dan, your new book is about love and revenge, and the backbone of it is time travel. What inspired you to do something about time travel?
I wanted to use time travel sort of as a metaphor or as a way to kind of explore the idea of going through your life, hitting these little points in your life that are, you know, like a flow chart where you go off in different directions and then something else happens and you go in another direction and then all of a sudden you're way over here when you started here and you're a very different person from what you were there. And so the idea of time travel where you can kind of examine this person that you were back here when you're down the road here and see, like, how the hell did that happen?
Well, thinking about that earlier version of you, I mean, have you thought about whether that person would recognize you now, what they would think about your career?
I think about that a lot. I think, what would I... Would I look at myself and go, oh man, he's bald with a beard. That's so depressing. I would have been sad about that, I think. And I would have thought, oh, his eyes have gone. You know, I had perfect vision back then.
Well, what about your career?
His posture is still bad.
Well, he set up a little bit. What about in terms of your career? With that person?
No, I would have been like, oh my God, like, how did that happen? I was expecting to, you know, work for Cracked Magazine for 4 years and then, you know, try to get work putting up aluminum siding or something.
Yeah.
Doing my prison drawings while I was, you know, down for a DUI.
Well, hopefully, I'm glad that things have worked out better than you thought they were going to go.
Yeah.
Well, you've said that you had this dispiriting experience where you'd worked on a book for a year and you're at an author signing event and then someone in line reads it while they're in line and they've finished it.
Oh, yeah. No, with the early comics, you know, they were like 30 pages and I had many times where, you know, I'd have a line and I was signing and I'd see somebody, oh, I'll get one of these and get it signed, and they would be in the line reading it, you know, and they'd get to the end and it would be like, why do I need this? You know, I'm done with this. And they'd put it back. And I once I was at some event at a comic book store, and I saw a guy come in who was sort of like a superhero guy, and he had dragged his girlfriend in, who obviously didn't care at all about comics. This was many years ago. And she was sort of looking around, and she saw Ghost World, and she said, oh, look at this. And she opens it to the middle, and she starts reading, and she reads all the way to the end. And meanwhile, her boyfriend is, you know, I don't know what he's wasting his time with. And then she gets to the end and she goes, She goes back to the beginning and reads. And then she reads up to the point where she started. And I was like, I've found another reader. And then she just puts it back and walks away. that was something I shouldn't have seen.
Well, it's a good thing you've made this one a little heftier than maybe.
That's right. Maybe she should hurt herself trying to put it back.
Jack Barlow, the main character, one of the other main characters in the book, he is traveling through time, and at one point he asks someone at a bar if you had the chance to kill Hitler's mom, would you do it? And the guy who's watching football, he says, I might after I go break Dan Marine's arm yesterday. So, and a lot of the book is about, part of the book is about personal motivations and versus civic duty when right. you have a certain right. power like this. Why was that interesting to you?
Actually, the reason I put in that line was just sort of an in-joke, was a few years ago I was interviewed for a magazine, a British magazine, one of the big daily papers, and I can't remember which one. And they have a column that's very much like the one that used to be in the back page of the New York Times magazine, you know, where they ask somebody very short questions and have very short answers. And so I did it all by email, and this woman asked me, you know, if you could go back in time, what would you do? And I wrote, if, you know, I'd like to say I would go back and maybe kill Hitler as a baby or find out if Jesus was actually a divine being, but probably I would just go back to my old neighborhood and like look around and, you know, see the kids I grew up with. And I later learned that when they print these in this magazine, they just cut it down to the bare minimum. And so it said, what would you do if you could go back in time? And it goes, I would kill Hitler.
Well, you actually have your character, Jack, go back to his old neighborhood.
Yeah, that's what, after I, you know, articulated that, I realized that that's sort of the, that's kind of what the story's about in many ways.
Have you done that yourself?
Oh, yeah. My mom still lives in the same house I grew up in, so it's easy.
Is that an enjoyable experience?
No.
No.
It's fraught with emotional peril, I will say.
But one that, is it edifying in some way?
Oh, yeah. I'm a grown man. I can take it. But it's quite something to see, sort of. It's like, you know, my mom has a lot of stuff in the house, and it's sort of like I can still see my stuff kind of under all the stuff, like it's like my childhood is preserved under old newspapers
under layers.
And stuff. Yeah.
Do you still have a room there? What's your
room?
Well,
sort of. I mean, there is a room that I used to live in that's now filled with auto parts.
With auto parts?
Yeah. My mom ran a garage in Chicago for years.
But she still has the auto parts.
She has the parts, not the garage.
Not the garage anymore.
My mom is now, she's 86 and she's a lawyer. She got her law degree when she was 76, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, she is an amazing person.
Is she practicing?
Yeah. She does elder law, not surprisingly.
this book, like the last two books you've done, Mr. Wonderful and Wilson, are a lot about people trying to create relationships in their lives, to have some sort of family, and it's sort of more in the domestic sphere. These books are things that you've written since your son was born, is that right?
Yeah, yes.
So what has been interesting you about sort of more of a domestic story?
Well, you know, it's obvious you have no idea how that's going to affect you to have a child. And I resisted having kids for a long time because I was terrified it would affect me. And I thought, I'm going to try to like get through this without having, you know, without even noticing that little brat in the other room. But you know, the minute you're sort of faced with that responsibility, you find out things about yourself that you maybe didn't want to face. You know, you find out what your true opinions are. You know, I find that when I'm talking in front of my son, I find I try to say like what I really feel rather than some version of myself I would have had in my 20s where I had some pose that was just, you know, I want to be contrary because of this various thing. You know, it was much more, I want him to know like what I actually really feel and like what are my real values. And you find yourself kind of really like, do I believe in this? And this, is this an actual, you know, opinion of mine, or is this just some masked, you know, thing I'm trying to put out to the world? And so I found it was like very profound in that way, that you know, I sort of became more myself in a certain way. And then you also have that thing of where you know, before that I thought of myself as like, you know, you always think like, I would take a bullet for my best friend or for my wife or something. And then you think like, yeah, if the gun was pointed at me, I'm not sure about that. Like, I'd probably be like, ah, you know, it's like, you know, I've got a lot to do here, you know, maybe not me. And then, you know, but the idea of like protecting your child, you really do know. Like, I would like, you know, carry a bear carcass through the Ozarks and with my teeth to, you know, what it's like, you would just do whatever it took. And it's a very different feeling. And that's sort of the kind of the one-dimensional nature of the guy's quest in this book that was sort of coming out of that.
Do you think that that desire, when you're around your son, to be honest as you can be, has that translated into your work?
I think so, because I think I then just, you know, sort of synthesize that and think, you know, what do I really think?
Your character Patience, who's the main character, the main character in the couple, expresses a lot of concern about being a parent, and there's this great image, I think my favorite image from the book. This is Jack and Patience lying in bed, and if you look around the room, it's a very frightening scene. How did you come? You can see there's faces in the covers, and there's demons on the shade. There's a creepy-looking guy in a window across the street. How'd you come up with this? Do you have a busy mind at night?
I have terrible insomnia, and I'm always lying in bed. From childhood on, I was seeing, you know, weird faces in the lace. We have like these lace curtains, and I just cannot unsee these demonic faces staring at me in the bedroom. And I actually like, have to remove stuff from the bedroom, so it's just completely nothing in there.
It's all two-dimensional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this, you know, this is sort of a worst-case scenario of how I would just see. And you see, earlier in the book, you do see the room and see that it's not like this at all.
It's not terrifying.
Right.
Part of this book gets into metaphysics a little bit. And this one character, Jack, is trying to figure out his place in the world. And there's some great imagery about sort of dealing with time and space and interdimensionality, I guess you would say. You had open heart surgery in 2006. Was that part of the reason why this book
why
kind of reckons
this?
With that?
Because
yeah, why you drew this?
Because I was on some kind of drugs or something?
No, but in terms of just, I mean, he's reckoning with his place in the world.
I did have a moment at that time where I thought like, well, this might be it, and I, you know, how do I feel about that?
Yeah.
And I was sort of weirdly like, well, it's okay, I'll be all right. You know, I felt bad, but I was sort of like, yeah, you know, I probably won't do anything good after this anyway.
We're listening to the interview Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger recorded with cartoonist Daniel Clowes. His new comic is called Patience. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger recorded with cartoonist Daniel Clowes. His new book-length comic is called Patience. He's best known for his comic book series Ghost World, which was adapted into a film, and 8-Ball.
Fantagraphics recently reprinted in a 2-volume set the first 18 issues of 8-Ball.
Yes.
You were very much involved in that. Was it enjoyable to look back at all that work? I mean, I know you've already done it for that the show that you were mentioning before, but
you know, I find there's sort of a lag time. If something is just a few years old, it makes me cringe. You know, I look at it and go, oh my God, this is a disaster. And if it's like 10 years old, I'm sort of, well, it's, you know, I was a young man. And this stuff seems so old, it's like, I was very forgiving of it. And I had to really like look back and go like, well, I worked really hard. You know, I remember working all the time, every day, all day, doing this stuff and trying to learn to do this, you know, do that kind of artwork. And it required like real tenseness on my part, you know. It was very difficult.
Did you have a desire to change anything or fix things that you thought were a problem at all? I mean, I know you've done that.
No.
when you've taken old stories and then had them come out again as a...
Yeah, this is, you know, the warts and all. In fact, there was an issue of Ghost World where the colors were printed in orange instead of blue for some reason. It was just that we were all like, why did that happen?
Right.
Nobody ever will find out. And I was like, no, we got to do the orange. It's got to be the orange Ghost World, you know,
because that's
how I saw it. I wanted it to be how I saw it the first time. But we did sort of, you know, digitally remaster everything, which means we had to get the original art back from collectors and things like
that. Right, because you sold a lot of it, right?
Oh, yeah, I used to sell everything for no money. And my dear friend, Alvin Buenaventura, who helped me with this, who just passed away a few weeks ago, did this amazing sleuthing work where he would find a collector who had sold it to another collector who had then traded it at an auction, who sold it to a comic store, who sold it to the... And he would somehow find these pieces and then con the people into sending us the artwork so we could scan it. So...
And then we'd
happen to lose it in the mail.
Yeah.
No, we weren't good about it. But it was, you know, it was... Because a lot of the stuff was, we just had no way to print it except the blurry comics, you know, and I didn't want to do that.
What was sort of the most surprising or fun thing about looking back at these issues?
I mean, I was really down on myself during that era. I was really always trying, like, I got to get better. And then looking back on them, I sort of was forgiving myself. I was like, you know, you did a good job. These are pretty good. And they're dense, and they're, you know, I always felt like I gave the readers their money's worth. You know, they were $3 or whatever, and I would kill myself for those issues, you know.
How long would it take to make an issue? I mean, you did everything.
I think the comic was supposed to be quarterly, and it was always like 9 months per issue.
Yeah.
It's hard to make a living on a $3 comic that came out once a year, but...
And you did all the lettering yourself,
too.
Oh,
I did everything. I did everything there could be done.
Do you still letter by hand?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Well, I know a lot of people use
computers.
I don't approve of that.
I can tell a mile away, and it always...
Really?
I feel like I'm reading a robot going like, and then I will go.
Well, I always thought amazing, too, that you did the lettering, but also the font you used was very elaborate, too. Like the narration always had these, I don't know what you call it, but these
the
little
serifs.
Flourishes. Yeah, the serifs on them.
Yeah.
That didn't drive you crazy doing this?
I could do it very quickly, yeah.
Really?
I'm a professional.
in your new book, Patience, you get to create a sort of science fiction world. Was that fun to do, to think about what the future might look like?
Yeah, it was less fun than I wanted, because I, you know, when I started, I thought, like, that'll be great to depict the future, and that's always fun to draw, you know, the future world. And then the more I thought about it and was trying to handle it the way I really thought it would be, it was like, the future's not going to be all that interesting. Like, I've got to sort of capture that it will be alien to us, but it will be not, I feel like it won't be as, you know, dystopic and advanced in another 15 years as we all anticipate through most of the science fiction stuff.
Dan predicts that in the future we'll all be wearing fuzzy yellow shirts, so just keep that.
That's
in mind.
Part of it. That's one of the fashion trends that I've invested a lot of money in.
Great. Well, thanks very much.
Thanks for putting up with my coughing fit.
Daniel Clow spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Clow's new comic book is called Patience. you'd like to catch up on interviews you missed, like our interviews with novelist Richard Russo, with Bronwyn Dickey, the author of a new book about myths and misconceptions about pit bulls, and Nancy Fishman, who co-authored a study on the misuse of jails, check out our website. You'll find those and many other Fresh Air interviews. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Chaloner. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Avalara, tax automation for businesses of all sizes. Avalara works to simplify sales tax and other business taxes with real-time rates and automatic filing at avalara.com, A-V-A-L-A-R-A.com. And from the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant-making and social investing. More at kresge.org.